Hello and welcome to Connecting Through Heritage, a podcast from the Leitrim County Council Heritage Project. In this podcast series, we're exploring the natural, built and cultural history of Leitrim, and we're speaking to the people who've made it their mission to celebrate it. Some are experts and others enthusiasts. What they have in common is a great knowledge for the county's heritage and a determination to preserve it. Local history is the theme of this episode. You've only to look at the number of historical societies and interest groups across Leitrim to understand the importance placed on the county's past. Today we're speaking to three members of these groups, all of whom can draw on invaluable knowledge of their towns and surrounding areas. And the history of these areas is the history of the people within them. From Carrick-on-Shannon's twin traditions, to the important legacy of the workhouse in Manor Hamilton, and finally to Drumshanbo, where the fate of the narrow gauge railway is intertwined with the story of emigration. We start in the county town, Carrick-on-Shannon. The history of this place begins with a bridge over the Shannon, a bridge which was replaced by the current one, built in 1846. The bridge is a handy metaphor for the development of the town, shaped as it was from the beginning by newly arrived Protestant planters and native Irish Catholics. This relationship, or the twin traditions as it's known, is of huge interest and relevance to Carrick man John Braden.
My name is John Braden, and I am chairman of Carrick and Shannon Heritage Group.
John spoke to me from the Visitors Centre in the former Church of St George's. It was originally built by the town's Protestant community as their place of worship, but as their numbers dwindled, it was turned into an interpretive centre that celebrates the town's twin traditions. John was part of the group involved in setting up the centre. It's a source of pride for John, who has lived in Carrick-on-Shannon almost all his life.
My family came from North Leitrim. We're Leitrim born, but my family came from North Leitrim in the 50s. My father got work at the local hospital here, and work was very, very scarce. There were seven of us in my own family. I was fortunate that I got a job locally. I got an apprenticeship in the local newspaper, the Leitrim Observer. And I stayed in that for roughly 20 years until I decided I joined the civil service, and I joined the office of the county registrar administering the courts here in Leitrim. I retired from that about 5 years ago. So basically, I've lived in Carrick all my life, all my adult life, you know.
We're going to talk about the twin traditions in the town, but before we do, what does this term mean? What are the twin traditions we're referring to?
It's really the tradition of the planter families that were brought in here after the plantation of Leitrim and the development of the middle class Roman Catholic families after the easing of the penal laws, and how it progressed from a 95% population of Protestant families in Carrick and Shannon down to only two, three families of the Protestant community left in Carrick and Shannon.
So let's start at the very beginning. What is the origin of Carrick-on-Shannon as a town?
The first references we have come across to Carrick and Shannon is in the what is known as the Annals of Lough Key. It's in Irish, actually. It's Cara Drumarusc, or UISC, the weir of the marshy ridge. And it's understandable why, because of that, the importance of Carrick. It was the idea of the ford across the Shannon, which was very, very few, it seems, in those days. There was very few crossings of the Shannon in this area. Again, prior to 1583, the most prominent local chieftains, native Irish, would have been the O'Rourkes of Breffony, who owned all the lands of Leitrim and up into Roscommon and part of Sligo. And again, with the Elizabethan local deputy, he's a fellow called Sir John Parrott. He imposed new boundaries after 1583 and the plantations of Ireland. And it was the first reference to County Leitrim came into being. Now, the 9 year war of 1567 to 1604 and the defeat of the Gaels, the great Irish chieftains, which included O'Rourke from this area at the Battle of Kinsale in 1601, it witnessed the collapse of the Gaelic order. So where you had the collapse of the order, where you had the landlord and the plantation families were brought in. You had the Peytons here in Carrick-on-Shannon, and you had Sir Charles Coote. Now, Sir Charles Coote was a very interesting person insofar as he got huge amount of land around Leitrim or mid-Leitrim there in Roscommon. And he was into the discovered iron ore in a local mountain here called Slieve an Éireann. And around that time, around 1613, he brought in 2,000 people, mainly English, and there was some Dutch, because they were making cannon. They had a big smelter there in mid Leitrim. And of course, Coote wouldn't train the Irish how to do that work because they were feared, you know, that they'd use it against them. Coote also built Jamestown, and he surrounded it with walls, which part of the walls are still there. Jamestown is about 4 miles from Carrick-on-Shannon here, you know. But from 1613 onwards, Carrick-on-Shannon was also established as a charter. James I was it or so, gave a charter to Carrick-on-Shannon. They also gave a charter to Jamestown because of Coote. But Carrick-on-Shannon got a charter, and it had four free burgesses which were nominated to the House of Lords, and they also had a commonalty. It's basically given the landlords all the lands around Carrick-on-Shannon, especially the St. George family. They got all the lands around Carrick-on-Shannon. They had to build a bridge, and they also had to establish Carrick as a fair destination for fairs.
Once the town was established then, who were the people that settled there?
In the census of 1659, the census showed that Carrick-on-Shannon had 47 families, and 14 of them were Irish. Carrick-on-Shannon had two places. In other words, you had the main town, and then you had the bridge, and across the bridge, it's called Curtober, and it was also known as the Liberties, and we're told that the Catholics lived up on that area.
What about the early Protestant community? Where were they drawn from?
There were mainly English, Scottish, there's some Welsh too, and I have to say, they weren't all planters, there were a lot of tradesmen. For instance, they were brought in, like I said, Coote brought 2,000 in to build cannon and to mine ore, iron ore out of Slieve an Éireann, and also later to mine coal out of Erigna. The majority of them would appear to be army, and again the usual small businesses and stuff like that. The great liberator Daniel O'Connell from 1846 to 1860 or so worked very hard, it would appear, and managed to get an easing of the penal laws, which allowed a Catholic middle class to develop.
Prior to the repeal of most of the penal laws in 1829 with Catholic emancipation, what was life like for Catholics in Carrick and its surrounding areas?
It would appear it was not good insofar as some of them might have owned a bit of land, and it was all taken from them, and they were put in as tenants, you know. Remember, Carrick-on-Shannon really was the town, the outlying area of Kiltohard, and all, a lot of that land was taken by the landlords. And in the town itself, it was an army barracks, really. The whole reasoning for Carrick, as far as the English Crown was concerned, was the defence of the Shannon. In other words, to prevent incursion across the Shannon up into further up into Connacht and stuff like that. And mainly it was a military barracks.
For listeners who won't know, can you explain what the penal laws were and what the effect of their repeal was on the life of Carrick-on-Shannon?
Basically, my understanding of the penal laws was that no Catholic could own property, no Catholic could join the professions, and really and truly, when Daniel O'Connell managed to get them to ease their regulations on the penal laws, in other words, give freedom to local businesses, local people to develop, it would appear that they made use of it and it developed very well. They went into the professions, and they went into businesses as well in Carrick-on-Shannon. So you saw a progression from the planter families running the business to the middle-class Catholic families running the business.
It sounds like society was hugely changed by this. What effect did it have on the character of Carrick?
There's a whole question of the decline of the Church of Ireland or the Protestant community in Carrick-on-Shannon, the decline of the Protestant community was mainly due to education and progress. The Church of Ireland, the Protestant community in Carrick, had the wealth to send their families or their offsprings to college and get a good education. But there was nothing in Carrick for them when they were educated. So they had to go someplace else to make a living.
For John, there's a significant moment that represents the spirit of cooperation between the two groups in modern-day Carrick. It came when he was involved with the establishment of St. George's as a visitor centre. It marks a transition even from the days when John was young.
In 1986, the Protestant community had declined to a couple of families. I think there was three or four families was all that was left. And their place of worship was deemed unsafe. In other words, the church that I'm in at the moment, the roof was falling in on it and it had to be closed. They had the Sunday service in the local hotel down here, which is owned by a Catholic family. Now, again, in those years, I was approached, two members in 1999, I was approached by, well, there were two friends of mine as well, but they were members of the church vestry of St. George's Church here, George Patterson and Arthur Laird. And they asked me if we could help to do something about St. George's. And we produced a suggestion or a plan to convert it into a visitor centre and retain it as a place of worship for the Church of Ireland community. But we drafted a lease, a 100-year lease, and the only condition attaching to it was that the Church of Ireland community would be allowed to use it every Sunday for their church services. But for the rest of the period, for the time, it'd be used as a visitor centre, a heritage and historical centre. And we agreed that and the lease was signed. Now, during the restoration of St. George's Church, in 2010, St. Mary's Church was closed for repairs. And I was approached by the parish priest, Father Garvey, here at the time, to see would they be allowed to say Mass in St. George's Church. Now, I remember growing up in the 60s, and the idea of putting one foot inside of a Protestant church was seen as a mortal sin. Here we had the parish priest of St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church requesting the use of the Church of Ireland as a place to say the Sunday Mass. I spoke to members of the church vestry, and every one of them agreed absolutely without any objections to allow the service to happen in St. George's Church. So for nearly 6-8 months, Mass was said every Sunday in St. George's Church. So to see the twin traditions, which there was so much divide and based on religious beliefs and everything else over the years coming together, it was absolutely wonderful.
St. George's Visitors Centre is open to the public and is a wonderful resource for understanding the twin traditions that begins the story of Carrick. If you were to visit Manor Hamilton today, you won't see the building that once functioned as the town's workhouse. It was demolished in 1954 and the site is now occupied by Our Lady's Hospital. But the painful memory of the workhouse still remains, as does the memory of the famine years, the tragedy with which the workhouse is most associated.
I'm Margaret Connolly and I live in Manor Hamilton, North Leitrim. Have a great interest in the local history, member of the Historical Society for many years. Do a bit of lecturing and a bit of writing, and generally just very interested in local history.
Margaret is making a bit of an understatement here. Margaret has studied the workhouse and famine period extensively and has come to know well a painful part of the Manor Hamilton story. I started by asking Margaret about Manor Hamilton in the 19th century. Who were the inhabitants of the town and the areas around it?
Now, when you talk about that time, you must remember that at that time, in the surrounds of Manor Hamilton and all rural areas, so much of the land was tenanted land, not owned land. So very many of the people were living really hand to mouth. They were there at the goodwill of the landlord. If he didn't like them, he could evict them. Times were very hard, And all of that sort of system led to so much poverty in Ireland. And when you think about it, for example, a tenant who had an acre of ground, he could grow 6 tons of potatoes in a year on that acre, enough to feed a family of six for a year, which is quite, I find that quite an interesting fact. Now, of course, the type of potato they grew was the lumper. There were many varieties of potatoes, but the lumper was the one that gave the greatest number of potatoes when you grew them, very susceptible to disease. And of course, that brings you to the terrible tragedy of the famine.
Let's first talk about the famine and how it impacted on Manor Hamilton. I mean, most people will think of the famine in Ireland as a series of events between 1845 and 1849. But were there similar episodes before that time?
Ireland was no stranger to famines. The Great Famine of 1845 to 49 was not the only famine that happened in Ireland. There were several famines, both before and after that time. The famine of 1845 to 49 was unique, I suppose, in a way, in that it started, of course, all that thing of the blight hitting the potatoes. That all started in America in 1833-34. The Americans didn't know what this disease was. Nobody knew what it was. It was transported in what appeared to be a cargo of good potatoes to Belgium. It spread in all that area of the Netherlands. It then spread to England, and it came to Ireland. And the first record of famine in Ireland was on the 20th of July, 1845, and that was recorded from the Botanical Gardens in Dublin by Dr. David Moore. And of course, in Ireland, because people were so reliant on the potato as food, it had utter devastation. Their main food was gone. So many people lived on the potato. Yes, they grew corn. Yes, they reared cattle. But what happened to those two products? They were exported to pay the rent. We know that between July of 1845 and February of 1846, £1 million worth of food left Irish ports in that couple of months. So you had to pay the rent. If you didn't, you were out on the roadside.
If we move on to talking about the workhouse in Manor Hamilton, was this institution built as a response to the famine?
No. Workhouses were built pre-famine. There was abject poverty. It was so bad that in 1838, the Poor Law Act was passed. And the workhouses really were the spin-off to the Poor Law Act. They were in actual fact an English solution to an Irish problem. But that was their answer to this dreadful poverty. So Manor Hamilton had a workhouse. It was built between 1839 and 1842. It opened for the reception of inmates, paupers as they were called, in December of 1842. And at that Christmas of 1842, there were 7 inmates in the workhouse. Our workhouse here was built for about 500. Each workhouse was governed by a board of guardians. It was their duties to see to all the various details of the workhouse, the running of it, the purchase of goods, just about everything.
What was the day-to-day experience of those forced to live in the workhouse?
Well, if you read George Nicholl's book about the famine and the workhouses and all of that kind of thing, it says in it, which was a very true statement, workhouses were built with the purpose of being joyless and devoid of comforts, so that only those who absolutely needed to be there would be there. It was cold. It was austere. The inmates slept on straw beds. When families entered the workhouse, they were separated. The men and boys went to one side. The women and children, the babies, went to the other. And for most families, they never saw themselves, never got together again, which was rather sad. The Grim Reaper, of course, claimed many. The workhouse bell called the people in the morning. It called them to work. It called them to eat. It called them to sleep. They lived by the workhouse bell. Food was scarce. 2 meals a day at the beginning, porridge in the morning, and this was all strictly measured out, so many ounces per person. Milk or buttermilk, whichever was available, that was breakfast, and an evening meal, which was, in the earlier days, of course, potatoes. That became a problem when the crop failed.
What was the purpose of the workhouse? Was it to enable people to get back on their feet so they could then re-enter society?
No, it was strictly a solution to the appalling poverty. It was never really designed to send people out again, because by the time they got to the workhouse, they were either ill or old, or if they weren't ill, they would be ill, because the places became overcrowded. And as you know, in all famines, it's not the hunger that kills most people, it's disease. The chances of you going out again into society were virtually nil.
Are there written records that tell us about the life of the workhouse at this time?
Here in Leitrim, we're fortunate to have a number of the minute books left. They are stored in the county library in Ballinamore. The minute books are interesting. They're interesting from the detail that they have, the minute detail of the purchase of goods in each week, from the chores that might have been going on at that particular time, from the record of people who died. And of course, as the famine worsened, that record became less accurate. And there were times when names were not recorded because I suppose people were under such pressure from this hunger and disease. Many times the records were not quite accurate. No names, just, for example, numbers of coffins ordered.
Do you get a sense from reading the minutes of any degree of empathy or pity for the inmates?
No, I don't, Tom. I do not get that. That, to me, it was never there. There was not sympathy or there was no empathy or any of those things. It was just a functional thing to combat this poverty, to deal with this, to be seen to deal with this poverty.
What about the inmates themselves? Does any written record survive that reflects their perspective?
None from those who entered that I ever knew of. For many, many, many years after the workhouse days, people really didn't speak about it, you know. It was an embarrassment to have had somebody who went to the workhouse. And, you know, it's amazing. It's only in recent times that people have come back. And I had somebody very recently, in the last number of months, who came from America looking for a relation who died in the workhouse here. It was just one of those bad things that one didn't speak about.
When did the workhouse close its doors?
The workhouse as such, which changed its name to the county home, remained in this town until 1936. The last 100 residents were then transferred to Carrigashannon. The building itself remained standing until 1954, when it was demolished and Our Lady's Hospital was built on the site.
Is there a painful memory of the workhouse and the famine still carried in Manor Hamilton?
I think perhaps not. I think in any town where there was a workhouse, that to a great extent the memory of it has gone. But I truly think that all that thing of the famine and the workhouses, I think that's deep in our psyche. And I think that that's why in times of famine or stress in other countries, that Irish people are extremely generous. I think they bat above the average in their generosity. And I think that comes from somewhere deep within us.
You've dedicated so much time to this era of Manor Hamilton's history. Why do you believe it's important?
Oh, for me, like, it's a mild form of madness, you know, this being interested in local history. I would never want the memory of the workhouse to go. And I would never want the memory of the World War to go. These things are very important in my life, that they would be remembered by future generations. When I speak out at the workhouse, I always end my conversation, little chat with people, with one thing. And I say to them, remember, this is holy soil. So many people lie here whose names were never recorded. It is a sacred place and should be treated as such.
That was Margaret Connolly speaking to me from Manor Hamilton. Drumshanbo was one of the stations on the Cavan Leitrim narrow gauge railway that ran up until 1959. The railway brought prosperity to the town, but its decline is tied in with the town's history of migration and more recent revival. A common denominator in all of this is Noel McPartland. Noel is a businessman and a great champion of Drumshanbo, as well as being the 2020 Leitrim Guardian Person of the Year. He grew up not far from the railway and has long collected photographs, films and memorabilia related to the railway and the history of the town. This wonderful historical record is on display in Glimpses of the Past, the history museum he runs in Drumshanbo. I asked Noel to introduce himself and tell us about his connection to Leitrim.
My name is Noel McPartland. Born and reared in Leitrim, 83 years ago, I saw the light of day actually in the Rotunda in Dublin and brought back to Drumshanbo 4 days later with my twin brother Sean. I spent all my childhood here. My father was in the Hackney business and my mother had a small shop here in Drumshanbo. So this is the home place where we're doing this recording.
How are you involved with preserving the history of Drumshanbo?
Glimpses of the Past, which we call our museum here. I set that up in 2012 or 13, the year of the gathering. And I had managed over the years a lot of stuff in the house. My father would have been the fourth generation in that house and I was the fifth. So we had a lot of stuff going back to the almost to the 1860s. I was a hoarder of stuff, not a great organiser, but a hoarder. And the year of the gathering gave me the opportunity to set up a little museum in Drumshanbo, which we did in a smaller premises. We ran that for what, three or four years, and then we decided the credit union here have a very big building in town, and they allowed us to go up to take the upstairs area. And we have photographs, all sorts of memorabilia about Drumshanbo going back to the middle of the 18th century. In fact, over the last 2 or 3 years since we got involved in Glimpses of the Past, more stuff has been donated. So what I started off with now is probably quadrupled in size in terms of data, photos, all kinds of stuff, really. It's quite amazing.
Was there anything before Glimpses of the Past that exhibited the history of the town in this way?
Prior to Glimpses of the Past, there was really nothing you could walk in and look at. You had to go and talk to the older people and get the information. Now, I find myself, I'm the older people, and people come to me. But when they come to town now, they come in, the first place they go, they might never have heard of Glimpses of the Past, but they'll go into the post office, and they'll ask the man at the post office about this, that and the other, and he'll say, go down and talk to Noel McPartland, and I finish up bringing them up to Glimpses of the Past, and then I go and help them do what they came to do.
You have a long-standing interest in the narrow-gauge railway that once served Drumshanbo. Do you have memories of the railway yourself?
I remember it so well because it was really a great place for us to go down and play. But the trains ran from Belturbet to Ballinamore, which was the main hub of the line, and from Ballinamore to Drummond to connect with the Dublin Sligo train. But then the train then was coming from Ballinamore to Drumshanbo. It was known as the tramway because it, for 90% of the way, it ran along the roadside. And it came to Drumshanbo twice a day and on to Arigna to collect coal from the Arigna mines, which is only 4 miles away, and go back with the coal then, and on its way down it would bring goods for the shops on that. We'd be often sent down to by my mother to the station to ask the man in the goods department, did the cigarettes come from Players this week, you know? As well as that, people came into town buyers from the north of Ireland to buy cattle on a fair day. And when the cattle were bought, they were shipped out on the wagons on the train to Belturbet to connect with the Northern Line. So the railway station played a big part in our lives. The memories I have of would be, first of all, the train whistling coming into Drumshamba, either from Origna or from Ballinamore. Get the beautiful waft smell of strawberry jam being made up behind my house here in Lairds. Those are the memories that never leave you, you know.
What sort of a service was the line set up to provide?
It opened in 1887 and it was closed in 1959, much to the annoyance of the local people and indeed generally the people in Leitrim. The decision was taken by Dr. C.S. Andrews to close it, and his name was never very popular around here as a result. The reason it closed, really, well, there was a good reason for closing it, really, because the mines had been selling their coal to the various factories around the country. But then the power station was built by the ESB down at Tarman, which is another 4 miles from here. And that actually took all the coal from Origna, and it resulted in the railway closing as a result.
I imagine the railway brought a lot of change to Drumshanbo. What sort of effect did it have?
Well, it brought in a lot of visitors, and it did lift. Drumshanbo was actually a booming town in those days because you had the Origna mines 3 miles away. You had Laird's various activities here, and there was good employment. But at the same time, there were so many people around, not sufficient to give full employment. That resulted in a huge emigration drain, particularly in the 1950s. To answer your question, Tom, the railway actually meant a lot to Drumshanbo. It brought visitors, it brought the railway enthusiasts who spend a week here, and I have some great pictures of that, one in particular taken in 1953, where these guys, there was 4 or 5 English enthusiasts on board the train, and they went to Origna on the train, but not about a mile outside Drumshanbo, there was a guy, two brothers actually, who came to visit me last year. They're living in England now. They came in a car. They were crossing the railway line to come into Drumshanbo, and there were several points of crossing, but there was this one out known at the Galley Bridge, which is only about a mile from Drumshanbo, and the car stalled on the line. The train was coming. Now, the train wouldn't be coming very fast. It'd be coming about 8 or 10 miles an hour. And the driver did spot them all right, but he put the brakes on. But by the time they got as far as the car, the train still hadn't stopped, and the car was tilted forward. The two brothers who were in the car escaped, shaken but unhurt, but the car was quite badly damaged. And the car was taken by the passengers on the train and the train people themselves, pushed aside and continued on. There was no question of closing the line for a week or a day even. They just continued on. The word came into town. I was home from secondary school at the time in Longford, and the word came into town that the train had crashed out of the Galley Bridge. And we cycled out, but we didn't get too close to it. But I have a fabulous picture in the museum of that particular incident.
The railway closed not long after that incident. How much of a blow was it to the town?
It had a huge effect. It actually it took away a very vital transportation system that brought people into town. It no longer was going to Origna, really. It took a lot from the commercial life of the town because it supplied the town with their goods from the various factories around Dublin and wherever. It was an awful loss, a very emotional time for everybody who knew the train.
What were you and your family's own experiences of that decline?
Immigration was rampant at that time, and my memory is of my father going, when I was much younger, before I went to America, of him collecting people from the American wake the night before. And he'd come into town with his clients, and I'd see them sitting in the back of the car crying. Some of them never would come back. A lot of them did, but some of them never came back. And he did the same thing with four of his kids, probably thinking, Joe, none of these are going to come back.
You were one of those children in your family who went to America, but you were the only one who returned to live in Drumshanbo. Why did you come home?
Well, when I came home in 61, I kind of got stuck into my old habits, meeting my old friends that are left there. I played football for the local team, even for that month when I was home. And I said to myself, I'd love to stay here, you know. And then the main reason I came back, I felt, you know, I was aware of my mother and father's age. There was nobody at home at that stage. I had at that time thought about coming back. So when my time was up in the army in December of 62, and I spent 8 or 9 months there, and then my mother wrote to me and asked me would I come home for a couple of months, because she and my dad were going to visit the rest of the family in America. I was running the shop here and doing the Hackney, and it was a fabulous time. But really, the main reason then I came back and stayed, I met my wife. She was working as a hairdresser next door to where we're living now. I met her in June, and I knew I didn't want to go back. And then I had the good fortune to meet Raymond Laird one day, and he asked me how I was doing and when was I going back. So I said, I'm going back in September. And he simply said to me, you know, he said, if you're around here in January, I have a job for you. It was as simple as that. And that's all I needed.
Of course, Raymond Laird was the owner of the jam factory in the town, and his job offer started Noel's long career at Laird's. Although the factory is now closed, the site is home to the Food Hub, a multi-tenant food production facility that Noel helped set up. Along with the Food Hub, Noel is proud of his work at Glimpses of the Past. It provides an important connection to previous generations of Drumshanbo people, particularly for the children of those who left.
I think that the most endearing thing about the whole thing is the people who come looking for their ancestors. When they come to Drumshanbo, they know nothing about Glimpses of the Past, but they go into the local post office and they ask who could they talk to about tracing the relations. And the Pascal McKenna, the postmaster, will say, talk to Noel McPartlett, he has a lovely little museum next door there in the credit union. They come down to me, and I had some great experiences of people who came back genuinely looking for their ancestors and where they came from. And there's one particular one, and it's only one of many, but this particular one always is first to my mind. A man and his wife came from Nova Scotia. Their great-grand ancestors had immigrated from Ireland, from Drumshanbo, sometime in the 1860s. And they were looking to know where the homestead was. Now, I hadn't a clue where that homestead was, but they mentioned the name of a family who are local here, Logans. And I rang Martin Logan. He's an electrician and he was working in Sligo, I think, that day. Now, it got me at a bad time because I had something else on that evening, but suddenly I found myself just immersed in this particular thing I was going to do. And I said, when I was talking to Martin, I said, would you guide me to where that house you're talking about is? So he stayed on the phone, and we drove out of Drumshanbo for about 4 miles, and we got to a townland. And when I got there, he said, cross the gate there, it's locked, but you'll have to cross it. And myself and the two Canadians, the lady had to cross the gate. it was very funny. And then we had to cross another gate in a second field. And when I got across the second gate, Martin said to me, now turn right and walk into the next field. Now you're in the next field, look up. And there at the top of the field was this shack of a cottage, which was in serious dereliction. And we walked up and got to the door of the cottage, and we had to break the door and got in. And we found some evidence of her relations, this lady. And she said she found a letter from America to the owner of the house, dated sometime in the 1930s. And then she knew she had found what she was looking for. I was so excited about it. I was enjoying it. And then I discovered there wasn't a word out of her. And she was over in the corner of the room crying. She just couldn't believe that she had found her ancestor's home. And when I tell this story, I always get a bit emotional myself, so you'll have to excuse me. But she was genuine. And they came out of there and they'd have crossed 40 gates to get back to Drumshambo. And they were staying actually in a hotel in Carrick and Shannon at the time. And they write to me from time to time, and there's a piece appeared in some paper in America, and my name was mentioned. And they were just nice people, but it was great to see them, having come all that way, to suddenly arrive in the spot where their ancestors came from.
And that's it for this episode of Connecting Through Heritage. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the local history of Leitrim's towns from the wonderful people helping to keep it alive. Connecting Through Heritage is a Leitrim County Council heritage project funded by the Heritage Council. It was produced by me, Tom Rosengrave, for One Little Studio.